pushed out by rising seas, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Miami, rising seas are making some people who live near the coast worried about flooding, and that can make other neighborhoods built on higher ground, like Little Haiti, more attractive.
I was having this conversation with a friend about how this changes the market, you know, in this area, makes it more valuable, so now we're going to definitely get pushed out of here.
So do you think that's already happening?
Oh, yes.
We'll check on whether climate gentrification is already underway in Miami. Also, after the repeal of net neutrality, what's the future hold for small digital companies serving communities of color here in the U.S.?
We have no idea whether or not this is going to essentially charge us out of existence.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you with us. Okay, so what's going on today? Every now and then, to get a sense of what is happening in other parts of the world, it's good to begin with a close look at something right under our noses, like here in the U.S. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to visit Miami and take a look at a trend that is just starting to take hold there. It also seems to be happening in other places. I'm talking about people on the coast moving away from rising seas to higher ground inland and pushing out the people who already live there. The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler begins in the Miami neighborhood of Little Haiti.
Schiller Sinan Jules is wearing dark aviator sunglasses and looking down the pastel-colored storefronts of Little Haiti's Main Street.
You ever seen the marketplace there?
This Miami neighborhood drew him in when the local businessman was a kid in the 80s.
I remember we came down here to get fried pork, fried plantains. It was a taste of Haiti.
As a teenager, he and his friends would grab drums and parade down this very street in a kind of Haitian second line.
Every Saturday night, this is where you'd find us. Sometimes we'd be out for 2-3 hours just walking, and there'd be like 100 people following the band, you know, so we had fun.
But Sinan Jules says the neighborhood is changing. Developers are buying up property and pushing out longtime residents.
It's not the same as it used to be before, because you don't have the Haitian influx that you used to have.
Gentrification is as old as cities themselves. Marginalized communities get priced out of neighborhoods as more affluent residents move in. The trend is driven by a lot of factors, but in Miami, some people are pointing to a new one, climate change. Closer to the beach, rising seas regularly cause water to push up through the ground during high tides. Flooding is more and more of a problem. But the spot where Sinan Jules is standing is some of the highest ground around, about 11 feet above sea level. So some residents of Little Haiti believe investors see their neighborhood as a safer bet and are buying up land.
For sure. I think that 100%.
Lydia Toussaint lives around here. I met up with her as she was walking out of a Haitian bakery with a fried fish patty in hand. She says the idea of climate gentrification hit home after Hurricane Irma made rivers out of roads in some parts of Miami in September.
We didn't really experience flooding. We really just got some down power lines. I was having this conversation with a friend about how this changes the market, you know, in this area, makes it more valuable. So now we're going to definitely get pushed out of here.
So do you think that's already happening?
Oh, yes.
Toussaint's parents have lived here 40 years, but are now looking at leaving.
They're older, they're retired, so their income is restricted, so they can't afford it. So now they're going to have to try to find something they can afford, but it's becoming harder and harder.
The term climate gentrification bubbled up here a few years ago and has gained traction, mostly among activists and journalists like me, who wonder if it's really a thing. Valencia Gunder definitely thinks it is.
What we're seeing is Little Haiti is going to be completely wiped out in the next maybe 5 to 10 years.
Gunder is a powerhouse community activist in the area, and she believes three big developments going in nearby are partly because of developers fleeing high water. And she says that's a big reversal here.
In Miami, historically, because of racism, redlining, and segregation, all of the brown and black people were forced to live in the center of the city, which also happens to be the high elevated areas. So they pushed us here because they didn't want us on the beach.
But today, the future does not look so good for that beach. Rising seas could put most of South Florida's coastal areas underwater by the end of the century. Nationwide, new research shows homes at risk from sea level rise are starting to lose value. And there's anecdotal evidence that in Miami, even renters are thinking about flooding.
So I live on the second floor in my apartment block, and that's a conscious decision.
Charles Bradley's apartment is in Miami's South Beach neighborhood.
You just see puddles appear, and it can be like the hottest day in July. And, you know, it's not come from the sky, it's coming out of the ground.
One day, Bradley couldn't drive to soccer practice through the flooded streets.
I literally had to float my car across the gutter to get into my car lot because the water was just insane.
But it's not like people have stopped building on the waterfront. Brickell is one neighborhood just south of downtown where the streets flooded during Hurricane Irma. Today, it's busy with jackhammers and cranes building towering new condo buildings in every direction. The population of this area has nearly tripled since 2000. So if the real estate market is still hot everywhere in Miami, are activists and residents just wrong about the impact of rising seas? Harvard professor Jesse Keenan says it's complicated.
Across Miami-Dade County, the higher elevation you are, the faster the rate of price appreciation across the entire county.
Keenan says there's a correlation between elevation and how much property values are going up. But that doesn't mean fear of rising sea levels is causing that increase. And Keenan doesn't think it is, at least very much.
We actually think that that is probably natural land pricing pressures that come from good old-fashioned gentrification.
Miami's beachfront has been expensive and built up for a long time, so new development is moving inland. Still, Keenan says that doesn't mean the activists worried about climate gentrification are totally wrong. He's had conversations with Miami developers and investors who say climate change is influencing their decisions. So it's just a matter of time before that starts impacting prices.
If it's not happening now, it's going to happen. 10 years, 15 years, who knows? But it's going to happen much sooner than later.
Keenan says the important question is what Miami officials plan to do about it. One of those officials is Jane Gilbert, the city's chief resilience officer. I asked her if the city has a plan for retaining affordable housing inland, even if people start to flee the beach. The short answer, not yet. The city's current priority is the coastline.
We've got a huge amount of built-out infrastructure along our coast. It's some of our most valuable real estate.
Gilbert's team is looking at what Miami can do to keep people living there through 2060 with something like 2 to 3 feet of sea level rise.
We feel that we can probably manage that without significant migration away from our coast.
Gilbert is considering ways to increase affordable housing citywide, but looking at high elevation areas specifically, that'll come later.
Right now, it's often hard for cities to plan beyond election cycle, so we're trying to work beyond the 20 to 40 year cycle, which is its own level of challenge. To plan out to 2100 is not something cities usually do.
By that date, it's possible people won't just be moving a few blocks inland. Recent research estimated more than 2.5 million people might move out of the Miami area entirely by the end of the century due to sea level rise. If that's the case, climate gentrification may not be a little Hades problem at all, but Orlando's or Austin's.
Lock up the store here so we could take a little walk.
For little Haiti businessman Schiller Sanon-Jules, gentrification has already taken its toll. He's closing his Haitian gift shop at the end of the year because his landlord doubled the rent. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Miami.
That research Carolyn mentioned at the end of her story about people decamping from South Florida, it was published in the journal Nature last spring, and it estimated that as many as 2.5 million people may leave the region if sea levels rise 6 feet, which could very well happen. Matt Hauer did that research. He's a demographer at the University of Georgia, and he predicts that several U.S. cities are likely to lose population due to rising seas.
I found places like Orlando and Atlanta and Dallas and Austin, these sort of southern cities that are relatively close to the coastline, or at least closer than, say, Detroit would be, that are also people are already moving from coastal communities into those areas and vice versa, and that have pretty strong economies.
So when I think about population shifts in the U.S., I think about the Great Migration decades ago and more recently people moving to the Sun Belt. How would migration caused by rising seas compare to those big migration shifts in size?
With sea level rise, without any kind of adaptive measures in coastal communities, we're looking at a migration that would be of a similar magnitude as the Great Migration.
Wow. What kind of population increases are we actually talking about at some of these places inland?
So places like Austin could see upwards of 800,000 additional people. Orlando and Atlanta could both see over 300,000. Phoenix could see over 100,000. Places like New Orleans could lose 500,000 people, and Miami could lose 2.5 million as well. So in some cases, we're looking at really large flows of people, and others we're looking at sort of smaller amounts of flows.
Surely with numbers like 800,000, that's going to cause some kind of tension in those communities.
I mean, I think there's that possibility if we don't properly plan for it, yeah. And this is just one climate change effect, which would be sea level rise, where the signal for migration is relatively clear. Whereas when you start factoring in extreme heat, extreme drought, tropical cyclones, a number of other climate stressors, there could be even more people moving.
Mm-hmm. Do you think places like Austin and Orlando are kind of ready to absorb all these climate refugees?
Well, I don't know if they're ready or not, but they should definitely start preparing and thinking about how to plan for this incoming wave of migrants. Absolutely.
And now, in the wake of Hurricane Maria, we're seeing 250,000 Puerto Ricans arriving in Florida, literally changing the demographics of the state. So I suspect you don't just see this as an interesting academic exercise for what might happen decades from now. Does the current news make you believe that your predictions are accurate?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, that's one of the things with when you do these kind of long-range models, you're never quite sure exactly what is going to happen. And the good thing is that without putting my thumb on the scale, I ended up recreating results the literature strongly suggests. And then when you start seeing the effect of Maria in Puerto Rico and where Puerto Ricans are moving to right now, it just adds further credence to what I was doing, further weight.
So your research focuses on the U.S., but what can you tell us about how sea level rise is likely to impact migration globally?
Well, we know in terms of climate migration, the working hypothesis right now is that most of that migration will be within countries if people are going to move. So not as much cross-border migration, as at least that's the current working hypothesis, than you would think that there would be. But across the world, it's somewhere between 150 million and 200 million people could be on the move because of sea level rise in particular.
Wow.
So
200 million people just from sea level rise.
Yeah. So we're talking about the potential for very large flows of people.
So the conclusion is that when we plan for sea level rise, we need to think not just about the coast, but also look inland. Is that for you like the big takeaway?
Oh, yeah. That's definitely it. We think about sea level rise as this coastal challenge. But if people move because of sea level rise, they have to move somewhere. And some are going to relocate within coastal communities, you know, a nearby area that might be unaffected. And other people are going to move landward into these landlocked communities. And if we don't start thinking now about incorporating these migration flows into long-term strategic planning, we have the serious potential of being woefully unprepared for what the future is going to hold.
Matt Hauer at the University of Georgia, thank you very much.
Thanks. It was great talking with you.
Hanukkah in Puerto Rico by way of Venezuela. Hey, that's why you listen to The World, right? That's coming up later on the show. We'll meet Meli Ravai. She and her husband left Venezuela around the time of Hanukkah a year ago to start a new life in Puerto Rico.
So I told one of my girlfriends, it's like we are newly married again, because we go and buy dishes and and pots and pans.
Then a few months later, Hurricane Maria hit the island and the power went out for weeks. Still is out in many places. So Ravai says this year's Hanukkah really feels like what it's supposed to be, the Festival of Lights.
A little light can dispel a lot of darkness, and you need to keep that light on in your own heart to be able to overcome all the problems that life throws at you sometimes.
Celebrating Hanukkah in post-hurricane San Juan. That's coming up later on the show. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's spend a few minutes on net neutrality. And before you turn the dial, I know net neutrality can be a little confusing, but know that in about a minute, you'll understand it really well. Okay, so you've probably heard that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, voted last week to scrap rules on net neutrality. Those rules had been put in place by the Obama administration, and they prevented internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast from blocking certain websites or charging more for certain content. It is confusing if you're not thinking about this stuff all the time. So here's an analogy we found really helpful.
So my analogy for what net neutrality means, I'll give the analogy in terms of cars and gas stations.
That's Vishal Misra. He's a professor of computer science at Columbia University. He says, think of your internet service provider, your ISP, as the gas station. And the model of your car, that represents the websites and apps you use, like Netflix or YouTube.
So net neutrality means that the ISP should be both price neutral as well as quality of service neutral. And the analogy is, if I go to a gas station, then the gas station doesn't get to decide whether gas is cheaper for a Toyota or a Ford. The ISP should not decide that this website is cheaper to use than the other one. The other aspect of net neutrality is the ISP should be quality of service neutral, in the sense that, you know, when I drive up to a gas station, the ISP should not decide whether I get 93 octane or 87 octane. That's my choice. The ISP should just deliver what I want.
So what happens to consumers now that net neutrality rules are scrapped? According to FCC Chair Ajit Pai, not much really.
The sky isn't falling, consumers will remain protected, and the internet will continue to thrive.
But net neutrality advocates like Vishal Misra don't agree. Misra says down the line, we could be paying more to access some websites. But in the short term, it will be up to the content providers themselves to do the paying so that their websites are not slowed down or blocked altogether. For heavyweights like YouTube and Netflix, that may not be a problem, but it could be impossible for smaller independent websites. Lucy Flores is a good person to talk about this. She's with MeToo, that's MITU, the digital first media company. It was founded just 5 years ago. And today it reaches about 100 million people in the U.S.
We serve primarily Latino and person of color, millennial audience. And so, you know, for us, it's really concerning that these big cable companies and telecommunication companies, there literally is nothing stopping any of them now from saying, well, YouTube, well, Snapchat, we're going to charge you extra now because you're producing X amount of videos or longer content or whatever. And those of us who use those platforms to distribute our content, they may very well pass along those charges to us. And we have no idea what's going to happen now or whether or not this is going to essentially charge us out of existence.
MeToo was founded in 2012, a few years before the Obama administration passed the 2015 Internet Order on Net Neutrality that the FCC voted to reverse last week. Just tell us, what did the 2015 order do for you? Did it help you and MeToo reach your target audience?
Well, what the 2015 order did for us and many other smaller digital startups is that it really just continued to solidify rules that had cumulatively been in place that protected access to the internet for all companies and for all people. I mean, these regulations didn't just begin in 2015. This actually has been something that has started ever since the dial-up modem.
Lucy, do you think MeToo would have grown as big and fast as it did in this new no net neutrality age?
Absolutely not. You know, we were able to build out our digital media company through the media distribution channels that were available for free to us. This is why it's also so important because, you know, we produce content that speaks to a Latino and multicultural audience. When you look at the media landscape, how is that content going to be produced? How are diverse content creators who don't have $1 million laying around, how are they going to enter these marketplaces if they might not be able to afford the access fees?
Lucy Flores, she's with MeToo, that's MITU, a web-based content platform. Lucy, thanks very much for your point of view on this.
Thanks for having me.
Let's go back now to Columbia University's Vishal Misra, because in addition to having great analogies, he also knows a lot about net neutrality in his native India. You see, as the U.S. moves to dismantle its net neutrality rules, India is moving in the opposite direction. India's telecommunications regulator has created a net neutrality framework that some say is the strongest in the world. I asked Misra what it feels like to be watching the opposite happening here in the U.S.
I find it humorous because I was very involved in the Indian process. My research area is actually a part of it is internet economics. And the definition that I gave for network neutrality, the pro net neutrality citizens movement in India adopted that definition. And the regulator also actually ended up passing regulations that are very consistent with that definition. So it's very bittersweet for me that, you know, in the country of my origin, I was able to make a difference and they have the strongest net neutrality laws, whereas here it's moving in the opposite direction.
Yeah, so why do you think this debate is playing out so differently in India and the U.S.?
One of the reasons is in India, the regulatory authority is led by a person who doesn't have any political affiliation. He's a bureaucrat, but a very wise and smart bureaucrat who's actually a computer science graduate. Hmm. So he understands the issues. He understands the internet really deeply. Unfortunately, in the U.S., the FCC has commissioners that are appointed on a party line basis. So whoever the president is gets three commissioners, the opposing party gets two commissioners, and the vote often is ideologically driven. Whereas in India, the head of TRAI, the regulatory authority in India, he ran a process which was very fair, open. He took in a lot of input. He had open houses where he took questions, he answered questions, he probed at it from every angle. Wow. So the process there was very different from the way the process ran, yeah.
So you're about to head to India on a trip, I gather. Given how involved you were in shaping India's policy on net neutrality, I imagine you're going to get peppered with all kinds of questions on where the U.S. is moving with all this.
Yeah, I'm sure. In fact, the day after I land, I'm giving a talk on net neutrality at my alma mater, IIT Bombay. And I'm sure they'll pepper me with questions on what happened and why it happened. And I think what happened, the FCC vote that happened, is not going to help competition on the internet. So if you're a dominant player already, then this is good for you. But if you're looking for the next Google or next Facebook to emerge, it's going to get tougher. So competition is always good for the consumer in the long run. And, you know, tomorrow you may not feel the impact of this, but in the long run, I think getting more ideas to compete evenly on the internet. Internet should be a platform where ideas battle, not money.
Could this have a ripple effect in India?
I don't think so. The Indian government actually is very pleased with the regulation that have been passed. And even after the FCC vote happened, the minister in charge of this in India said, you know, we'll stay true to net neutrality.
And how do they characterize that move? I mean, how do they see that kind of commitment to staying with net neutrality as opposed to, hey, let the big fat cats win at this game?
You know, India is, you can say India is the next startup nation after Israel. There's a lot of entrepreneurial activity in the online and internet space happening in India, and they want to encourage new ideas, so they might see net neutrality as a competitive advantage.
Vishal Misra, a professor of computer science at Columbia University. There's a whole lot more to say on net neutrality, of course, and you can count on us to stay on the story, a more accessible story now that you've got that handy gas station car analogy. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up, how a federal crackdown on suspected transnational gang members may have led to some wrongful arrests.
A school resource officer witnessed a fight and using extremely problematic generalizations, categorized one young man who happened to just be standing near there as a gang member.
That story just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. If you're immigrating to the U.S., where do you go? If you're lucky, you go someplace where you've got family and where you can find a job. That goes for anybody, really. But in this case, I'm describing the route taken by many undocumented immigrants, hoping to start a new life with at least some support. That's how Henry Lemus Calderon ended up in Nantucket, that tiny wisp of sand off Cape Cod here in Massachusetts. Nantucket is an elite summer playground that requires lots of maintenance, so there are lots of jobs. Calderon followed his uncle there after he fled violence in El Salvador as a young teenager. But before long, Calderon ended up being targeted by federal immigration authorities on the hunt for gang members. We heard that part of Calderon's story yesterday. Today, what his story tells us about who's targeted for arrest in gang sweeps and why. Here's my WGBH colleague, Philip Martin.
On the grounds of the Bristol County Jail in Dartmouth, Sheriff Thomas Hodgson takes me on a tour of the immigration center that he built.
This building, it's got two wings that are basically a sort of open dorm setting and with two rec yards on the back of each one.
I'm escorted into one of the wards for deportees. 19-year-old Henry Lemus Calderon is incarcerated here, and he can't figure out why. Though in the country illegally, he was never arrested for any crime and never ordered removed, and he bristles at the notion of being considered hardcore.
How do you feel when someone says you're a gang member?
I feel bad because I am not a gang member.
Calderon, 5'10" and broad-shouldered, says he was stereotyped by fellow students as a gang member. His chains clatter as he speaks.
So, my friends, they told me that when I went to the school, he said, yo, that guy is look dangerous, look like bad boys.
A high school tough guy, perhaps. But Calderon never imagined he would become an example of what Donald Trump calls a vile criminal cartel. Calderon's friends say his arrest was either a case of mistaken identity or the result of ethnic profiling.
My friends are Dominicans, Guatemala guys, different groups like...
Gang member or not, how Calderon ended up here was the result of a closely coordinated priority operation between federal and local law enforcement targeting MS-13 and 18th Street gang members on Nantucket. His name appeared on a 2015 police report with a notation that said 18th Street gang member, submitted by an officer attached to Nantucket High School. In recent years, gang recruiters were kicked off the high school campus. Police were increasingly worried about gang activity on the island and were keeping tabs on suspects. Lieutenant Angus McVicker of the Nantucket Police says that information was shared with Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agents, or ICE. Next, those agents would
make a determination on whether or not maybe someone's illegal or not legally here in the country, and then they would take actions on their own.
But not entirely on their own, acknowledges McVicker.
We assist with transport with ICE agents, and our job is to make arrests and identify persons in this instance that could possibly be part of a gang.
And that's really key to being successful in gang enforcement.
That's ICE's Matthew Etri.
Because the local authorities are the practitioners in their communities. They know exactly where the trouble spots are, who the individuals are that are causing that trouble.
Etri, until recently, headed up Homeland Security investigations for ICE in New England. He insists that the Nantucket operation that nabbed Henry Calderon and other accused gang members over the past year were not indiscriminate.
We have targeted operations, we have surveillance, and we try to take them into custody in the most safe in secure fashion without creating a lot of issues within a particular neighborhood.
And some Salvadoran workers on the island, seeking to protect themselves and their community from extortion and potential violence, have cooperated.
I know how dangerous they are, and if I see a little movement of gang members, first thing I will do, I'll report to the police department.
That's Isidro Lemus. His brother Rodolfo says ICE agents have continued to conduct raids on the island since their nephew, Henry Lemus Calderon's arrest in May of 2016.
A couple months ago.
Did they pick anyone up when they came?
Yes, get a couple kids. But this is no good kid. This is the gang members.
But the American Civil Liberties Union in Massachusetts wants to be sure. Cade Crockford, who heads the group's Technology for Liberty program, says ICE, under the guise of a crackdown on transnational street gangs, has been scooping up innocent young men. She calls it a school-to-deportation pipeline. The ACLU is pursuing a case in East Boston similar to Henry Calderon.
Huge similarities. In East Boston, a school resource officer witnessed a fight and wrote in the police report about not only the students who were directly involved in the fight, but also about some of the students who were standing nearby. Using extremely problematic generalizations, categorized one young man who happened to just be standing near there as a gang member.
And as with the cases in Nantucket, says Crockford, that information was shared with ICE.
This young man turns out to have been undocumented and was, on the basis of that information, seized and put into deportation proceedings because of this Boston police policy that allows the BPD to share that type of information with the federal government, even absent any evidence of wrongdoing.
But ICE argues that being in the U.S. without papers is wrongdoing enough.
We might arrest someone who we've encountered while we're looking for another person.
Sean Neudauer, a spokesperson for ICE, says if Massachusetts residents are in the country without the proper papers, their fears are well-founded.
While we may prioritize a MS-13 gang member, we're not going to ignore people who have committed very few or if no crimes whatsoever, but are still here in this country illegally.
And that worries undocumented immigrants in Nantucket and across the state. Rodolfo Lemus, for one, is rethinking his family's cooperation with Nantucket police because of the coordinated ICE operation that landed his nephew in detention. Lemus, a U.S. citizen, says his undocumented friends on the island, janitors, painters, carpenters, and other workers, are also less willing these days to cooperate.
Before the ICE, when they come in here, they are looking for one guy. He's a bad guy, you know. The ICE is saying, don't worry, it's, I come in only for one guy. Now it's changed everything.
For The World, I'm Philip Martin on Nantucket.
Philip Martin joins me now in the studio. Philip, your reporting really brings up questions about immigration and enforcement and profiling. Calderon was arrested in May 2016. Obama was still in the White House. I mean, we hear Trump talk quite a bit about the gang MS-13, but how much different really is his administration's anti-gang strategy from Obama's?
It's not that different in one crucial area. That is that the MS-13 and 18th Street gang, they're targeted. They are a priority. But the difference with the Trump administration is MS-13 and 18th Street gang, but particularly MS-13, have become more than just a priority. It's become a bête noir, a boogeyman of sorts, in a very visible way. Many experts point out that it's being used to rationalize Trump's larger immigration policy. It's a way of scaring, if you will, the bejesus out of people. Mm.
For you, as you reported Calderon's story, what concerns were raised?
Well, first of all, there's a very real concern of public safety. You have a legitimate presence of people who call themselves gang members on Nantucket. But a larger issue that Salvadorans are concerned about all over the country, as well as Guatemalans and Hondurans, is that school resource officers and others can basically point to someone as a gang member based on any number of arbitrary factors, standing around watching a fight, having a friend who says they're a member of MS-13 in 18th Street. Their names end up on police reports, and those police reports are read by ICE. ICE's priority is to arrest MS-13 and 18th Street gang members. They see the name on the police report and go, aha, and they target those particular individuals.
So kind of a formalized profiling.
Well, ICE will tell you, and they've told me, ICE will tell you we do not profile. We do not racially profile. We do not ethically profile. I've interviewed ICE officials where they are adamant in pointing this out, that they don't do this. But if you talk to immigration advocates, if you talk to those on Nantucket who say they have been profiled, they have a contrarian view. They say that's absolutely what's happening, that you have a tattoo. You don't have a tattoo, but you happen to be from El Salvador or Honduras or Guatemala, you could be targeted.
So what else did law enforcement tell you about how they decide what is a gang and what constitutes gang membership?
They basically said that there's some variance about what that means. They say that, look, gang situations, gang symbols have changed. They don't necessarily wear tattoos. And it becomes harder and harder to identify who is a gang member. But you also have a situation where they, and this is where immigration policy comes in. This becomes why people are really concerned. They said it doesn't matter if you're a member of a gang. If we happen to go in your apartment or happen to knock at your door and you are undocumented, then you're going to be arrested. So a lot of people believe this is a proxy issue for basically tackling the larger issue of undocumented immigration.
My colleague here at WGBH, Philip Martin, thanks very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Marco.
Imperialist, a Cold War mentality, those are some of the words Russia and China are using to characterize President Trump's new national security strategy. Trump rolled out the strategy in a speech yesterday in which he touted his America First mantra and singled out Russia and China as global rivals. For some perspective on the president's speech, we called up Lacey Healy. She's a foreign policy fellow at the Stimson Center in Washington and the host of PRI's new podcast, Things That Go Boom. Lacey, what stood out for you in Trump's speech yesterday? Any surprises?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you say Trump's speech, because Trump's speech was very different from Trump's actual strategy document. And that's, I think, what stood out the most to me. The strategy document is a laundry list of threats and a wish list of capabilities. And so it's very aspirational what the president hopes to achieve during his time in office in the national security realm. And so it's written, this one largely by his advisor, H.R. McMaster, and it reflects McMaster's very internationalist perspective. It's pro-diplomacy. It talks about fighting terrorism and shoring up cyber capabilities. But in his speech, there are some key places where the president disagrees. The Trump administration has proposed a 30% cut to the State Department. Tillerson has offered buyouts to key diplomats. And really, a lot of folks are now saying that it's a ghost town over at the State Department. But the strategy itself actually says diplomacy is key to our role in the world. And that's a pretty big dichotomy there.
And in the document, are Russia and China kind of characterized as rivals, as Trump said in his speech?
Yes. So they're actually characterized even stronger as adversaries. The document is very strong on Russia and China. In fact, it calls out Russia for meddling in other democracies. And it stops just short of calling out Russia as meddling in the U.S. election. But Trump stopped much shorter than that. In fact, he only mentioned once that Russia and China were rivals. And then he moved immediately on to talk about his recent phone conversations with Vladimir Putin.
So what do you think Russia and China are going to react to? What can they react to, the written document or Trump's speech?
After this written document and Trump's speech, I think that our allies and adversaries alike will be much more confused. Trump has empowered his advisors strongly, but those advisors disagree with each other. The budget strategy doesn't look like the national security strategy, and neither of those strategies look much like the things that Trump is saying publicly. So if you're Russia or China, you're looking at this whole mess of a strategy, and you're thinking, it doesn't look much like a strategy at all. It looks like they don't know what they're doing.
You know, one thing that Trump underscored several times is that economic security is key to national security, which kind of sounds a lot like Barack Obama, right?
It does, yes. In many ways, this is a continuation of Obama's policies, things like really talking about American prosperity. But in a lot of ways, also, it diverges. Things like climate change, which Trump now does not consider a national security threat, and the U.S. Treatment of China, which was a sort of cautious embrace under the Obama administration, now has turned to a much more adversarial view and something that will really change our relationship with China.
I mean, in so many cases, as we've seen, Trump tends to be exceptional. But in past White Houses, how much do presidents actually stick to the national security strategy they've laid out?
National security strategies in the past, they're written very vaguely. And this national security strategy is no different. And that's partially on purpose. They don't necessarily guide policy in a very specific way. But they are often used to justify policies. For example, President Bush, when he invaded Iraq, had put out a national security strategy just 6 months before, and it was really used as the ideological justification for that war. So often these national security strategies, they sort of fly under the radar. And this one is different because Trump chose to roll it out with a speech, which other presidents have not done. There's a lot more fanfare around it this year.
Lacey Healy is a foreign policy fellow at the Stimson Center and the host of PRI's new podcast, Things That Go Boom. It premieres on January 22nd. You can catch a preview right now just about anywhere you get your podcasts. Speaking of things that go boom, Saudi Arabia buys more U.S. weapons than any other country. President Trump has made a priority of keeping good relations with the Saudis, including continuing President Obama's support fighting a war in Yemen. Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from reporter Iona Craig on what the U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen means.
On the logistics front and on the weapons supplies, the Saudi coalition has had this support from the U.S. and the U.K. I mean, the U.K. in weapons sales have soared in the period of the war, of course, because the Saudi coalition now have this, you know, constant appetite for more bombs needed for the air war and for the bombing campaign. The US is even more involved because they're actually making it logistically possible for those air raids to be carried out. They're providing fuel to the Saudi-led coalition fighter jets that are carrying out bombing raids on a daily basis. Without those fuel supplies, they wouldn't be able to carry out those air raids. So they're particularly crucial to that.
Reporter Iona Craig on 1,000 days of U.S. involvement in the Yemen civil war. That's coming up tomorrow. And it's also Hanukkah. Tonight's the last night of the Jewish holiday, which celebrates light in the darkness. That has taken on a special significance this year for Jews in Puerto Rico. That's where Daniela Cheslow met a couple who are living in San Juan after fleeing the violence and economic collapse in Venezuela.
Adonai.
On the first night of Hanukkah, the Chabad Center in San Juan hosts a candle lighting in its high-ceilinged sanctuary. You can see marks on the ceiling from hurricane damage. The crowd is pretty thin. Most years, hundreds of tourists are in town, but this year, they didn't come. Still, there are a few dozen people and fresh potato pancakes that the rabbi's wife brings out on a tray.
These are delicious.
I thank you.
I meet Meli Ravai while we eat latkes.
Where are you from? Are you
Venezuela.
From here? Venezuela.
Meli is 58 and a doctor by profession. A year ago, she and her husband moved here from Caracas. They were settling into their new life when Hurricane Maria hit. The message for this year's Hanukkah?
A little light can dispel a lot of darkness, and you need to keep that light on in your own heart to be able to overcome all the problems that life throws at you sometimes.
I went to visit Meli at her apartment. It's on a street lined with storm-battered buildings and palm trees, right on the water. I walk through the gate and up to her door.
Hi!
Welcome.
As I arrive, Meli irons her husband's shirts.
It's supposed to be permanent press, but it's not.
She doesn't work as a doctor now. She says it would take too long to get licensed in Puerto Rico. Meli was born in what was communist Romania. Her family fled to Venezuela when she was a baby. She spent her whole life in Caracas. She says at one point there were about 30,000 Jewish people in Venezuela, but many of them emigrated as the economic situation deteriorated. Meli could see that decline on the streets.
There were more people looking for food in the garbage. The roads were not kept well, and it was even getting dangerous to walk to the synagogue.
Their son moved here to San Juan. He worked in the family business, a lumber store. With no family left in Caracas, Meli and her husband eventually followed. They landed in San Juan last December, found an apartment, and started outfitting the kitchen.
I told one of my girlfriends, it's like we are newly married again, because we go and buy dishes and cutlery and pots.
In late September, as Hurricane Maria approached, Meli and her husband waited out the storm with their son, his pregnant wife, and their young daughter. The rain came pouring down. The hurricane-proof windows leaked, and they dashed to keep the floor dry.
You take a towel, you pick up the water, you drain it in the bucket, and then repeat as needed.
The next day was the Jewish New Year, and Meli picked her way through the flooded streets to get to synagogue. Then they assessed damage. Their apartment had no power, and the family lumber store had lost its roof and walls. Her husband and son drove back and forth to the store to make repairs and waited hours in line to get gas.
How did it feel as a Venezuelan to go through what you went through here after the storm?
Well, it was very strange for us. There were lines to go to the supermarket and lines to buy gas. But I thought, well, it's the United States. Somebody has to help us.
To cope with the stress, Meli went for daily walks on the beach and prayed for electricity. On one of those walks, she saw the lights go back on her street. A guard in her building told her the electricity worked, and they moved back in.
3 days after that, the light went off again. And we said, we are not going to move back to my son's house yet. Let's wait a little bit.
When I visit, there are still cases of water by the front door and an emergency lantern on a coffee table. She takes me to a window where we can see the beach where she walks. Palm trees sway in the afternoon air.
Yes, they survived the storm.
For The World, Daniela Cheslow, San Juan.
Venezuela's long economic collapse is hard for all Venezuelans living outside the country these days. And for many in that diaspora, music is a powerful coping tool. The World's Brandy Fullwood has more on that. ¿Qué más tiene que pasar
para aceptar? La Estrella Regular is a danceable lullaby by Venezuelan artist Algodón Egipcio. The lyrics gather a narrative about a star that's constantly going in and out of brightness. In the context of the crisis in Venezuela, the song paints a much clearer picture for writer Veronica Valletti Flores.
One of the ways that I experience diasporic loss is the inability to come by information that really can give me an honest picture of what's happening. I feel like I'm always piecing things together and I never know enough.
The coverage she can get a hold of sometimes doesn't really help, so she reads it with a grain of salt.
You feel impotent also to see things happening and what could I do? What should I do? Like, you know, it feels a lot more overwhelming than interacting with like the emotional aspect of how this all feels to folks.
Yeah, so it definitely makes sense to me and maybe to you why anyone would use music or art to understand situation, because that ends up digging into emotions, which is
right,
a little bit easier to understand.
Yeah, I can believe my emotions, right? And that like I can interact with people's emotions without having to be skeptical.
When I first read Veronica's work, I read about it in the context of Venezuelan artist Arca. She wrote about his latest album and how diasporic loss resonates with her as a theme, and how they both have this attachment to a home away from home. But when I spoke with her recently, Agaron Egipcio really resonates with her lately. The lyrics don't lend themselves to harsh details of economic disparities. There's no mention of crumbling oil prices or food shortages, and there's a lack of political tension in the lyrics. Instead, it's poetic and ambiguous.
Algo Egipcio, I think, is in Mexico City now, and he talks about, in La Historia Regulares, about how he needs to come to terms with the Caracas that he knows and that he fell in love with and that he grew up with doesn't exist anymore. So this song of La Historia Regulares is about coming to terms with, you know, Venezuela changing really rapidly, and that notion of this place that felt like home just not being there anymore.
For The World, I'm Brandy Fullwood. Una imagen
de postal que se borró. Brandy's work is part of Future Folk, our collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. So we leave you with La Estrella Irregular, that song by Algodón Egipcio, an artist whose name literally translates as Egyptian cotton. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back here with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.